time for Wednesday's hour number two on Hashtag Daily K with your host, Peter Bint. Korean dramas, movies, and even lyrics. Why is the world paying attention to Korean stories?
From classics to modern masterpieces, time to dig deep into the charms of Korean literature.
Oh, check it out!
With Paul.
Paul is in the studio. If you watch the video stream, you'll see a squabble while pretending to conduct the music.
Fun.
You told me to do it properly, so I took your pen because
that's... You got your own pen.
Yeah, but I thought you meant, you know, you're the proper conductor, so I need your... What is one of those things called?
Baton. Conductor's baton. B-A-T-O-N.
It's too small for... When I think of baton, I'm thinking of, you know, we say baton touch in Korean a lot when you're doing a relay race.
Yes, it's way a different bigger. Kind of baton.
No, they can't be the same thing. That's crazy.
They're not the same thing. They're different kinds of batons.
So do you
Are you
know-
saying that a knife... Knives all look the same?
Yep, exactly the same.
So a Have chef's knife seen... and a peeling knife is different?
It's exactly
the same.
Exactly the same. Yeah.
I'm not gonna win this argument this
Good
way.
Good point, Paul. How are we doing on the 1st of November?
Remember the 1st of November. I don't know why.
Did you do anything yesterday, last night? See any ghouls and ghosts around? Because a lot of our American listeners are celebrating that right now, Halloween.
Yeah, I know. Well, in Korea this year, I did Halloween shows on the weekend for kids. I was in three shows in Seoul and three shows in Daegu.
Interesting.
So that was fun because we had kids dressing up. They were great. There was a barista. There was a Princess Peach from Super Mario.
Wow.
At one of the storytelling workshops, there were four Snow Whites in the same workshop.
Snow Whites?
Yeah.
My daughter even had a Snow White costume. Maybe that's cheap or easy to get in Korea.
It's classic. And they looked fabulous. So it was a lot of fun. Yesterday I watched a horror movie. Fell asleep early.
What did you watch?
Oh, it was one of those old ones. I don't know. The Omen.
Oh.
Yesterday.
With
yes.
Damien.
Yeah.
I've never seen that.
It's very good.
Really?
Classic
horror. Is it still creepy, though? That's what I want to know.
Oh, look, demonic children are always creepy.
But, you know, because it's an old film, I think about The Exorcist as well, which I haven't seen either.
You never saw The Exorcist?
No, because I was such a scaredy cat when I was little. I watched, what was it? Werewolf in London.
An American Werewolf in London.
There we go. Well, I say I watched it. I listened to it while my friends watched it and I was hiding under the covers. So
it's not that scary. It's a comedy horror.
Well, I didn't know. And so the audio, I built up a really terrible image in my mind.
Sure.
But I do wonder, if you watch it in this day and age, with all the CG that has come a long way, do you just think, oh, that's rubbish now?
Not with films from the 70s and 80s, because it wasn't CG.
Okay.
It was all practical effects. Okay. And some of it does look silly. But, for example, in American Werewolf in London, the transformation scene of the guy when you first see him turn into the wolf and the whole process is a stunning piece of, I think it was stop motion animation in terms of, you know, adding bits and hair and so on and him changing.
Wow.
It's extraordinary. And yes, it can look a little bit hokey, but you have to understand, like everything, it was made at the time with what they had to make it.
Of course. Today's book, it's a really tough read.
Yeah, I just want to say this right now. If you get triggered by some of the issues that we're talking about, you don't have to listen today. Don't feel like you have to, because we're dealing with a really disturbing novel. It's a very good novel. It's a very important novel, but it's going to be a hard... talk. It's going to be a hard listen.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be careful myself about how we talk about this.
Okay.
But at the same time, we're dealing with issues that can really be difficult for some people. So so I'm just going to say that right now.
Okay.
The book we're looking at is called Dogani. The English title is the Korean title.
Oh, wow.
It's spelled T-O-G-A-N-I. It's by Gong Ji-young and translated by Bruce and Ju-chan Fulton. And it's basically a searing indictment of what can happen when a community wants to focus on respectability and the status quo rather than people in trouble, rather than those who are suffering.
Yeah, and yeah, there's a lot of abuse in this novel. The film starred Kong Yu. I watched that. I haven't read the book, I got to say. It was in 2011.
It was a huge hit at the time. Very controversial because both the book and the film are inspired by a true story. And we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Okay.
But it was a huge hit, but also incredibly shocking.
Yeah, I remember watching that in the cinema and coming away with my jaw dropped. Silenced is the English title to the movie.
Yes.
Okay, so tell us a bit about the author, Kong Ji-young.
We featured her before. I think it was a couple of years ago we did Our Happy Time.
Okay.
Which is a story about a young woman going to see a man in prison and their sort of friendship that developed from there. And she writes about social issues. I think that's a big part of her work. And she was actually quite politically active when she was at university in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. She was involved in the student movement. And she wrote about that at first when she became a full-time writer in the late 80s.
Yeah.
But I think also her focus has been on the struggles of women, mm-hmm. and issues. And also in the case of this, she's dealing with child abuse on a systemic level.
Yeah.
Hugely popular in Korea. She's won loads of awards. And it's great that we finally have this book translated into English because I think it is one of the most important books in modern Korean literature.
Was the English translation much later for this?
Yeah, this has only just come out this year. This came out late spring.
That's interesting. Bruce Fulton and Ju Chan, they are a great couple team.
Yeah, we've covered them a number of times, often for short stories and classic fiction. And they usually work together. Sometimes Bruce works with other people, but mm-hmm. usually it's Bruce and Ju Chan translating together. They're very old school.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that can work really well for some books and not so well for others.
Okay.
For example, I noticed in this translation of Dogani, there was a moment or two where I questioned the use of some terms, some uh-huh. language.
Okay.
For example, a couple, they refer to each other as dear.
Dear.
Yeah, okay. This is a young couple.
Oh, dear.
And I see, oh, when dear. I hear someone saying, dear, let me tell you this, or whatever, I think of somebody in their 80s.
Of course.
I would use, because I think in Korean we say, chagia.
Mm.
So maybe there are translators that are fitting for certain things and not yeah. for others. And it's interesting as we read more and more translated literature to pick up on this kind of thing.
Sure. Okay, so where are we going to pick this up? Because this is a pretty long story. The film as well is pretty long, more than 2 hours. Do we need to set the scene?
Well, we're starting at the very beginning, so I think this will give us an introduction to one of the main characters and also the rather creepy location of the novel. As Kang In-ho was loading his car with a meager set of belongings and setting out from Seoul, the maritime fog began its creep into the city of Mujin. Rising from the sea like a huge, colourless beast, it advanced onto the mainland, a damp, dense landfall moving forward, ever forward. The objects in its path, like soldiers sensing imminent defeat, surrendered to the vapour, which absorbed their amorphous shapes into its bosom. Among the swallowed structures was a four-storey building of stone perched on a bluff overlooking the sea, the home of benevolence. As the mist engulfed the building, the light escaping through the window of the dining hall on the first floor turned the color of mayonnaise. Elsewhere, a church bell began to toll, calling the faithful to the Sabbath worship. The tolling reverberated in the distance, the only sound to penetrate the fog. Along the railroad tracks near the home of benevolence walked a boy, and as he walked, the fog lowered like the fine mesh of a net, effacing everything it met. Besides the tracks were beds of cosmos that had blossomed early for the season. They paled and trembled as the fog trapped them in its fine weave. The boy was 12, but if you were to stand him next to other boys his age, you would see how absurdly short he was, how withered and bony he looked. The boy's striped t-shirt, the color of bleached sky, was wet with mist. Something wasn't right with the boy. He walked with a limp, but you couldn't have made out his expression, which was masked by the advancing fog, and soon the rest of him was sucked in, but his feet on the cross ties could feel the faint tremor, its measured pulsations. The Sunday worship at the First Church of God's Glory in the Mujin city centre commenced at 10 a.m. The fog had already encroached on the church parking lot, and you might have heard an occasional muffled bump as latecomers attempted to squeeze in, high beams helpless to prevent the nudge of fender against fender. The fog devoured the headlights and everything else in its path, in defiance of the scripture then being read in the sanctuary. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The church custodian, helping to park the cars, dropped his keyring. He bent over and located it only with difficulty. "Damn thick," he muttered. His voice was lost in the swell of the organ accompanying the choir. The tracks began to rattle. The boy looked back to where the railroad made a wide bend. The train was coming. He held out his arms as if to embrace it. Was that a smile on his face, or a grimace? The next moment his lips rounded in an outcry, but the sound he produced was eerie and inarticulate. No vowel or consonant could have been distinguished.
Maz says, can I buy this in a Korean bookstore while I'm in Korea at the moment?
Sure. Yeah. You can. Of course, you can buy the Korean version. The name is the same. It's spelled Dogani. If you go to one of the big bookstores in Seoul, and there are a couple of them, a certain K bookstore, for example, they normally have good sections, like a table's worth of translated literature. So there's a good chance that it will be there. I highly recommend getting your hands on it.
Do they often like update quickly, like if it's released in English?
Yes, I would say I haven't had a problem finding the translated books I want.
Uh-huh.
When I go to the really big stores that I know, for example, there's one in Gwanghwamun where I know that I can get every book. In fact, there's an independent bookstore in Gwanghwamun that stocks nothing but translated literature and books about Korea.
Oh, wow, really? Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. So the English spelling for this book is T-O-G-A-N-I. I guess that's how you'd search for it with the English title there.
Sure.
You'll find it. Okay, so this boy, it seems like he's about to get hit by a train.
Yeah.
So what happens in the home of benevolence? Is that something religious? Because we're talking about like the Sabbath as well.
Well, religion's involved here. I'm sorry, but the boy dies. He's hit by the train. And it's the end to a short but awful life at this so-called home. And so we're led into the home of benevolence by Kang In-ho, who's one of the main characters. And he's got a job as a teacher there.
Okay.
He's had a bit of a rough time in terms of work and not being able to find anything to do. And he's managed to get this job in Mujin, out in the sticks. And his wife and daughter are back in Seoul, so he's away from them. He's not taught since soon after he graduated.
Okay.
And there are hints that maybe there was something going on then, some issues.
Okay.
And so he's got this job at the Home of Benevolence. And this is a school and dormitory for deaf and mute children.
So kids are boarding here, right?
Yeah, not every kid boards, but most of them do. Mm-hmm. And they all have a hearing disability.
Okay.
So they stay in the dormitory at night and they're taught at school in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kang arrives. He gets to his new accommodation, his own apartment. There's an old university friend called Soyujin who's living there, and she welcomes him. She works for the Human Rights Center in the area.
Okay.
And she takes him out for his first meal, and everything's okay. First night's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But then his first day at the school the next day is awful. It's strange. It's weird. The administrator and the principal don't act in the way he expects, higher-ups in a school to act.
Uh-huh.
They're identical twins.
Yep.
They're in their 60s, and they got bad attitudes.
Mm.
And he's a little shaken by the way they speak to him and their attitudes towards him. And then he gets to go to the classroom and to meet his students for the first time.
Yeah.
And he tries to sort of make them feel at ease.
Yeah.
But they're obviously upset. They're distressed. One boy is crying.
Uh-huh.
It's like they don't trust the teachers in this school. And he tries to comfort this boy.
Yeah.
And one of the kids writes down on a piece of paper that his brother died yesterday, and they know who killed his brother.
That's the kid that we heard
about.
Yeah,
the kid that was hit by a train. So this is all really discombobulating for Kang. He doesn't know what's going on. He meets some other teachers who also have bad attitudes.
Yeah.
But he's like, okay, I have to do my job. And there's even things like hearing screams from a locked girl's bathroom.
Oh, no.
And the next day, one of his students is absent. Her name is Yondu. She's 15 years old. And he asks, where is she? And a member of staff says, oh, she left the dormitory last night, so she's being reprimanded at the computer room. And he goes to find out what's going on. The administrator's there, who, again, treats him so rudely. And then later, one of Yondu's best friends, Yuri, who also has a mental disability, pulls Kang to the room with the washing machines, to the laundry room, where Yondu is about to be tortured by one of the staff members and some of the older girls.
Tortured?
Like putting a hand into the washing machine as it spins.
Oh, my goodness.
So he stops them. He reprimands them. He takes her away from them. And he tries to warn her. But the thing is, his sign language is really basic. And he's trying to communicate with her. And he's also really upset and frustrated with everything that's gone on. And it doesn't go quite as maybe he planned it. And that's where we'll pick up on the second excerpt.
Here we go.
"Don't break the rules," he said in clumsy sign language. "I want to help you." But the next words he could only shout, "Take care of yourself. You have to take care of yourself." Yondu's dark eyes opened wide. And instantly Kang hated himself for shouting at this girl who had been interrogated the entire day and then cruelly punished. If they had been able to communicate through speech, he would have phrased his words differently. He would have spoken at length, reasoned with her, conveyed a teacher's affection for a student, and made himself understood. But he couldn't do this using sign language. Again he took Yondu's hand, and as they walked down the hall he could hear behind them the footsteps of Yun and the other girls. Had there ever been a time when he was so cognizant of, so sensitive to every kind of sound? Barely 2 days here and he was exhausted. "Damn it, can't hear, can't understand what I'm saying, damn it all!" he couldn't help muttering. Yondu's hand wiggled inside his. Another sign of her discomfort, he told himself. A sigh escaped him. He gave up trying to sign to her and resumed his muttering. "This hasn't been easy for me. I had to swallow my pride. I'm in a sad situation, but I never expected this. I want you to trust in me, please. I want you just to go along with what I say, please." Upset at Yondu's attempts to free her hand, he gripped it more tightly. And then he realized she was trying to communicate with him, using her hand as a writing instrument and the palm of his hand as a surface. He could still hear the footsteps behind them, and felt the hair rising on the back of his neck. He released Yondu's hand and watched as she wrote on his palm what looked like the number 010, or was it the symbol ing? Tight-lipped, he focused on his palm, sensing the tension in his hand. Yondu wrote slowly and carefully, and just as carefully Kang followed her finger until she had finished. What she had written was indeed 010, followed by 8 digits, a phone number. And then, "Phone Mum, come see me." Still aware of the footsteps behind them, Kang looked at Yondu importunately, but she failed to return his gaze, and to his surprise didn't seem concerned. Once again, she inscribed the telephone number on his palm. Kang brought the busy finger to a stop and used his own finger to write on her palm. "Okay, okay." Only then did the tears pooling in her eyes begin to drift down her cheeks.
Okay, so she wants her mum to come, right? It seems like a cry for help, and Yondu's being punished like this. For leaving the dormitory on the surface. That's what
he's been told, but it's at this moment where everything starts to unravel, where the secrets start to come out.
Okay.
Because her mother comes. She's trying to look after her husband, who's very sick in hospital due for surgery. And the next thing we know, we cut to Soyujin at the Human Rights Center, and the mother coming to see her and asking for help.
Oh.
And she tells So that Yondu was sexually assaulted by the principal.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. And then So, she's incredibly shocked by this. In the evening, she meets with Kang to talk about it. Kang is also incredibly shocked, but he starts to put together the pieces of what he witnessed, the scream in the bathroom and things like that. And what's worse is the children, including Yondu, claim they've told teachers several times before, but they've always been shushed up.
Oh,
don't
no.
talk about it. No, don't make a fuss. Don't lie. And so we get So investigating and Kang talking to the children, and page by page as the story evolves, it becomes clearer and clearer that there are both girls and boys who have been beaten or sexually assaulted by either the principal, the administrator, or another teacher who looks after the dormitory.
There's three people involved.
Plus, you've got the bullying woman who supervises the dormitory and tortures children as well.
Awful.
And so Yondu agrees to give recorded testimony at the centre in front of cameras so it can be recorded.
Yeah.
And they get an interpreter who's a university student, and she's with her friend Yuri, and they tell the staff and Kang and the others there what happened to them. And it's so shocking and appalling, you know, that the people listening, the witnesses to this statement, are crying out and in tears. And this next reading comes towards the end of Yuri's testimony, Yondu's best friend, and it's a difficult moment in the book. It's not the most difficult moment, but again, I just want to say, you don't have to listen to this. It's an important story, and for those who have the stomach for it, it needs to be told, it needs to be read, it needs to be listened to.
As we said, inspired by a true story makes it all the worst.
The interpreter's face clenched and he broke off. Yuri munched nonchalantly on a choco pie, with everyone waiting for the interpreter to continue. He looked to the staff who had been his classmate. He was on the verge of tears, his expression a combination of outrage and astonishment that told his friend he could not possibly continue. His lips trembled. "What is it?" asked the classmate. "What did she say next?" The interpreter hung his head. Kang, who had been watching Yuri all along, shifted his gaze to the others. "He tied her," he said in a low voice. "Tied her arms and legs to the table." The interpreter nodded, confirming Kang's words. Another cry escaped the staff who had cried out earlier, but this time Saw didn't respond with a disapproving look. The interpreter, gritting his teeth and trembling, had still not looked up. His expression had changed to shame, as if he himself had been the one victimizing Yuri. Or perhaps being a male, an adult, or a virginal man prevented him from holding his head high or even speaking in the presence of this disabled girl. He shook his head no. Perhaps he found it horrifying that he inhabited the same world, breathed the same air as those who had abused this small, bird-like girl who looked light enough to lift with one hand. Oblivious to the young man's predicament, Yuri began signing again. Instead of the played-out young man, it was Yondu's mother who interpreted, her face moist with tears. "He told me that if I didn't listen to him, he would tie me up again, he would kick me out, and he wouldn't give me money to go home. I hate all of them. The principal, the administrator, Teacher Park. I hope they get punished." And then Yuri yawned. Kang was reminded of the impassive eyes of Palestinian and African children he had seen in photos. Overwhelmingly painful circumstances had left no feeling in those eyes. He couldn't help thinking of his daughter, Semi. If she had been born a boy, would he be feeling any less heartache now? His musings were broken by the voice of the director. "Now that we've finished recording for the day, we need to remove Yuri to a shelter. We can't return her to where she's being abused. The same goes for Yondu."
So painful. Is this towards the end of the story? Do we find out what happens in terms of prosecution, police?
We're not even halfway through.
Wow.
This is the turning point. Now that the truth is out there.
Okay.
But the rest of the book is this incredibly painful journey towards, well, what they hope will be justice, and the uncertain fate of the children, but also their abusers. Are they going to be sent to jail? What's going to happen? And as we go further into the book, we're sort of exposed to the figures of authority in the town, and we're exposed to the people who want to help, but also the people who choose to turn a blind eye, the people who are ignoring what's going on, or the people who claim it's not their responsibility. And so we've got this whole town taking sides, and then there's a public trial, and it is messy.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say any more than that. You need to read it yourself. And I would say if you're Fan is a difficult term, but if you like reading legal dramas and crime and about this kind of thing, then it's a brilliantly written book. But it's also the sort of book that will make you angry. I was reading this on the train going back and forth to Daegu on Sunday, and that was the anniversary of what happened in Itaewon. And it compounded my feelings of anger because it's all about people in power not taking responsibility and those who are at fault not being punished.
Yeah.
And I won't say anything more about Itaewon, but we see this happen in Korea. It's not just one time. And this is inspired by a true story.
So there's a lot around this that is fictional. For instance, they're not identical twins.
No. So it didn't happen in Mujin, it happened in Gwangju.
Uh-huh.
What happened was in 2005, there was a discovery of widespread abuse at a school for hearing impaired students in Gwangju. There were six perpetrators. Uh-huh. Two of them never went to prison because the statute of limitations had expired, so they couldn't be charged. Two were released after less than a year.
Goodness.
And four of the six teachers were reinstated at the school.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
So there's a reason why Gong Ji-young had to write this book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an indictment of a systemic issue, not just in Korea, but all over the world, where victims are ignored and people in positions of power are allowed to get away with atrocities.
That's awful. Tigerish makes the good point that history is full of tales like these, heartbreaking ones, where you wonder how people can be such monsters, perhaps even worse, and there are more stories that will never be told. And never have been.
Yeah.
It's sad, but absolutely true, I guess.
The word that comes to mind is also complicity. Because there are people who know what's going on and choose not to say anything.
Yeah, I think most of us think, of course we'd speak up. But, you know, it's sometimes not easy to do. It takes a lot of courage, but you would hope that the majority would speak up. But, yeah, being complicit is almost as bad.
Yeah, right? Well, you'll see if you read the book that Kang's past becomes a weapon against him during the trial. There's all sorts of things going on there. It's brilliant, but it's painful. And if you're anything like me, you will want to punch a wall after you finish reading this.
Goodness. One-line review, please, Paul.
An excellent, rage-inducing, horrific tale of abuse and injustice. It has to be read.
Next week's book, anything a bit more light?
We're going experimental short fiction, something, sorry, it's going to be dark for next week. The week after, we're going to go light again, so don't worry. It's called Left's Right, Right's Left by Han Yuju, translated by Janet Hong. It's a brilliant, very strange, very unusual short story.
Interesting. Looking forward to that. Well, thanks for your brilliant, heart-wrenching reading today.
Yes, thanks to everyone. Thanks to the Literature Translation Institute of Korea for help with copyright permission. Thanks to Gong Ji-young for a harrowing story and to Bruce and Ju-chan Fulton for their translation. I will be back next week with another book.
You can listen to Check It Out with Paul Matthews on Arirang Radio's hashtag Daily K every Wednesday from 10 a.m. KST.